Chapter 26. The sun was up, throwing long shadows out into the clearing, and Bruce stood beside the ford and looked across the bridge at the corrugated iron shelter on the far bank. He relaxed for a second and let his mind run unhurriedly over his preparations for the crossing. Was there something left undone? Some disposition which could make it more secure? Hendry and a dozen men were in the shelter across the bridge, ready to meet any attack on that side. Shermain would take the ford across first. Then the lorries would follow her. They would cross empty to minimize the danger of the bridge collapsing or being weakened for the passage of the tanker. After each lorry had crossed, Hendry would shuttle its load and passengers over in the shelter and deposit them under the safety of the canvas canopy. The last lorry would go over fully loaded. That was regrettable, but unavoidable. Finally, Bruce himself would drive the tanker across, not as an act of heroism, although it was the most dangerous business of the morning, but because he would trust no one else to do it, not even Ruffy. The 500 gallons of fuel it contained was their safe conduct home. Bruce had taken the precaution of filling all the gasoline tanks in the convoy in case of accidents, but they would need replenishing before they reached M'Sapa Junction. He looked down at Shermain in the driver's seat of the Ford. "Keep it in low gear. Take her over steadily, but slowly. Whatever else you do, don't stop." She nodded. She was composed, and she smiled at him. Bruce felt a stirring of pride as he looked at her, so small and lovely. But today she was doing man's work. He went on. "As soon as you're over, I'll send one of the trucks after you. Hendry will put 6 of his men into it, and then come back for the others."
"Oui, Monsieur Bonaparte."
"You'll pay for that tonight," he threatened her. "Off you go." Shermain let out the clutch, and the Ford bounced over rough ground to the road, accelerated smoothly out onto the bridge. Bruce held his breath, but there was only a slight check and sway as it crossed the repaired section. "Thank God for that." Bruce let out his breath and watched while Shermain drew up alongside the shelter.
"Allez!"
Bruce shouted at the coloured engine driver who was ready at the wheel of the first truck. The man smiled his cheerful, chubby-faced smile, waved, and the truck rolled forward. Watching anxiously as it went onto the bridge, Bruce saw the new timbers give perceptibly beneath the weight of the truck, and he heard them creak loudly in protest. "Not so good," he muttered.
"No," agreed Ruffy. "Boss, why don't you let someone else take the tanker over?"
"We've been over that already," Bruce answered him without turning his head. Across the river, Hendry was transferring his men from the shelter to the back of the truck. Then the shelter started its tedious way back towards them. Bruce fretted impatiently during the 4 hours that it took to get 4 trucks across. The long business was the shuttling back and forth of the corrugated iron shelter, at least 10 minutes for each trip. Finally, there was only the 5th truck and the tanker left on the north bank. Bruce started the engine of the tanker and put her into auxiliary low. Then he blew a single blast on the horn. The driver of the truck ahead of him waved an acknowledgement and pulled forward. The truck reached the bridge and went out into the middle. It was fully loaded, 20 men aboard. It came to the repaired section and slowed down, almost stopping.
"Go on! Keep it going, damn you!"
Bruce shouted in impotent anger. The fool of a driver was forgetting his orders. He crawled forward, and the bridge gave alarmingly under the full weight. The high, canopied roof rocked crazily, and even above the rumble of his own engine, Bruce could hear the protesting groan of the bridge timbers.
"The fool! Oh, the bloody fool!" whispered Bruce to himself.
Suddenly he felt very much alone and unprotected here on the north bank, with the bridge being mutilated by the incompetence of the truck driver. He started the tanker moving. Ahead of him the other driver had panicked. He was racing his engine. The rear wheels spun viciously, blue smoke of scorched tires, and one of the floorboards tore loose. Then the truck lurched forward and roared up the south bank. Bruce hesitated, applying the brakes and bringing the tanker to a standstill on the threshold of the bridge. He thought quickly. The sensible thing would be to repair the damage to the bridge before chancing it with the weight of the tanker, but that would mean another day's delay. None of them had eaten since the previous morning. Was he justified in gambling against even odds? For that's what they were. A 50-50 chance. Heads you get across, tails you dump the tanker in the middle of the river. Then, unexpectedly, the decision was made for him. From across the river, a Bren gun started firing. Bruce jumped in his seat and looked up. Then a dozen other guns joined in, and the tracer flew past the tanker. They were firing across towards him, close on each side of him. Bruce struggled to drag from his uncomprehending brain an explanation of this new development. Suddenly everything was moving too swiftly. Everything was confusion and chaos. Movement in the rear-view mirror of the tanker caught his eye. He stared at it blankly. Then he twisted quickly in his seat and looked back. Christ! He swore with fright. From the edge of the jungle on both sides of the clearing, Baluba were swarming into the open. Hundreds of them running towards him, the animal skin kilts swirling about their legs, feather headdresses fluttering, sun bright on the long blades of their pangas. An arrow rang dully against the metal body of the tanker. Bruce revved the engine, gripped the wheel hard with both hands, and took the tanker out onto the bridge. Above the sound of the guns he could hear the shrill ululation, the excited squealing of 200 Baluba. It sounded very close, and he snatched a quick look in the mirror. What he saw nearly made him lose his head and give the tanker full throttle. The nearest Baluba, screened from the guns on the south bank by the tanker's bulk, was only 10 paces away, so close that Bruce could see the tattoo marks on his face and chest. With an effort, Bruce restrained his right foot from pressing down too hard, and instead he bore down on the repaired section of the bridge at a sedate 20 miles an hour. He tried to close his mind to the squealing behind him and the thunder of gunfire ahead of him. The front wheels hit the new timbers, and above the other sounds he heard them groan loudly and felt them sag under him. The tanker rolled on, and the rear wheels brought their weight to bear. The groan of wood became a cracking, rending sound. The tanker slowed as the bridge subsided. Its wheels spun without purchase. It tilted sideways, no longer moving forward. A sharp report as one of the main trusses broke, and Bruce felt the tanker drop sharply at the rear. Its nose pointed upwards and it started to slide back. "Get out!" his brain shrieked at him. "Get out! It's falling!" He reached for the door handle beside him, but at that moment the bridge collapsed completely. The tanker rolled off the edge. Bruce was hurled across the cab with a force that stunned him. His legs wedged under the passenger seat and his arms tangled in the strap of his rifle. The tanker fell free, and Bruce felt his stomach swoop up and press against his chest as though he rode a giant roller coaster. The sickening drop lasted only an instant, and then the tanker hit the river. Immediately the sounds of gunfire and the screaming of Baluba were drowned out as the tanker disappeared below the surface. Through the windscreen, Bruce saw now the cool, cloudy green of water, as though he looked into the windows of an aquarium. With a gentle rocking motion, the tanker sank down through the green water. "Oh, my God, not this!" he spoke aloud as he struggled up from the floor of the cab. His ears were filled with the hiss and belch of escaping air bubbles. They rose in silver clouds past the windows. The truck was still sinking, and Bruce felt the pain in his eardrums as the pressure built up inside the cab. He opened his mouth and swallowed convulsively, and his eardrums squeaked as the pressure equalized and the pain abated. Water was squirting in through the floor of the cab, and jets of it spurted out of the instrument panel of the dashboard. The cab was flooding. Bruce twisted the handle of the door beside him and hit it with his shoulder. It wouldn't budge an inch. He flung all his weight against it, anchoring his feet on the dashboard and straining until he felt his eyeballs starting out of their sockets. It was jammed solid by the immense pressure of water on the outside. "The windscreen!" he shouted aloud. "Break the windscreen!" He groped for his rifle. The cab had flooded to his waist as he sat in the passenger's seat. He found the rifle and brought it dripping to his shoulder.
He touched the muzzle to the windscreen and almost fired, but his good sense warned him. Clearly he saw the danger of firing. The concussion in the confined cab would burst his eardrums, and the avalanche of broken glass that would be thrown into his face by the water pressure outside would certainly blind and maim him. He lowered the rifle despondently. He felt his panic being slowly replaced by the cold certainty of defeat. He was trapped 50 feet below the surface of the river. There was no way out. He thought of turning the rifle on himself, ending the inevitable, but he rejected the idea almost as soon as it had formed. Not that way. Never that way. He flogged his mind, driving it out of the cold, lethargic clutch of certain death. There must be something. Think, damn you, think! The tanker was still rocking. It hadn't yet settled into the ooze of the river bottom. How long had he been under? About 20 seconds. Surely it should have hit the bottom long ago. Unless... Bruce felt hope surge into new life within him. The tank. By God, that was it. The great, almost empty tank behind him, the 5,000-gallon tank which now contained only 400 gallons of gasoline. It would have a displacement of nearly 18 tons. It would float. As if in confirmation of his hope, he felt his eardrums creak and pop. The pressure was falling. He was rising. Bruce stared out at green water through the glass. The silver cloud of bubbles no longer streamed upwards. They seemed to hang outside the cab. The tanker had overcome the initial impetus that had driven it far below the surface, and now it was floating upwards at the same rate of ascent as its bubbles. The dark green of deep water paled slowly to the colour of Chartreuse, and Bruce laughed. It was a gasping, hysterical giggle, and the sound of it shocked him. He cut it off abruptly. The tanker bobbed out onto the surface. Water streamed from the windscreen, and through it Bruce caught a misty, distorted glimpse of the south bank. He twisted the door handle, and this time the door burst open readily. Water poured into the cab, and Bruce floundered out against its rush. With one quick glance he took in his position. The tanker had floated down 20 yards below the bridge. The guns on the south bank had fallen silent, and he could see no Baluba on the north bank. They must have disappeared back into the jungle. Bruce plunged into the river and struck out for the south bank. Vaguely he heard the thin, high shouts of encouragement from his gendarmes. Within a dozen strokes he knew he was in difficulties. The drag of his boots and his sodden uniform was enormous. Treading water, he tore off his steel helmet and let it sink. Then he tried to struggle out of his battle jacket. It clung to his arms and chest, and he disappeared under the surface 4 times before he finally got rid of it. He'd breathed water into his lungs, and his legs were tired and heavy. The south bank was too far away. He'd never make it. Coughing painfully, he changed his objective and struck upstream against the current towards the bridge. He felt himself settling lower in the water. He had to force his arms to lift and fall forward into each stroke. Something plopped into the water close beside him. He paid no attention to it. Suddenly a sense of disinterest had come over him, the first stage of drowning. He mistimed a breath and sucked in more water. The pain of it goaded him into a fresh burst of coughing. He hung in the water, gasping and hacking painfully. Again something plopped close by, and this time he lifted his head. An arrow floated past him. Then they began drooping steadily about him. Baluba, hidden in the thick bush above the beach, was shooting at him. A gentle pattering rain of arrows splashed around his head. Bruce started swimming again, clawing his way frantically upstream. He swam until he could no longer lift his arms clear of the surface, and the weight of his boots dragged his feet down. Again he lifted his head. The bridge was close, not 30 feet away, but he knew that those 30 feet were as good as 30 miles. He couldn't make it. The arrows that fell about him were no longer a source of terror. He thought of them only with mild irritation. Why the hell can't they leave me alone? I don't want to play any more. I just want to relax. I'm so tired, so terribly tired.
He stopped moving and felt the water rise up coolly over his mouth and nose. "Hold on, Buss, I'm coming." The shout penetrated through the grey fog of Bruce's drowning brain. He kicked and his head rose once more above the surface. He looked up at the bridge, stark naked, big belly swinging with each pace, thick legs flying, the great dangling bunch of his genitals bouncing merrily, black as a charging hippopotamus. Sergeant Major Raffarero galloped out along the bridge. He reached the fallen section and hauled himself up onto the guardrail. The arrows were falling around him, hissing down like angry insects. One glanced off his shoulder without penetrating, and Ruffy shrugged at it, then launched himself up and out, falling in an ungainly heap of arms and legs to hit the water with a splash. "Where the hell are you, boss?" Bruce croaked a water-strangled reply, and Ruffy came ploughing down towards him with clumsy overarm strokes. He reached Bruce. "Always playing around," he grunted. "Guess some guys never learn." His fist closed on a handful of Bruce's hair. Struggling unavailingly, Bruce felt his head tucked firmly under Ruffy's arm, and he was dragged through the water. Occasionally his face came out long enough to suck a breath, but mostly he was underwater. Consciousness receded, and he felt himself going, going. His head bumped against something hard, but he was too weak to reach out his hand. "Wake up, boss. You can have a sleep later," Ruffy's voice bellowed in his ear. He opened his eyes and saw beside him the pile of the bridge. "Come on. I can't carry you up here." Ruffy had worked round the side of the pile, shielding them from arrows. But the current was strong here, tugging at their bodies. Without the strength to prevent it, Bruce's head rolled sideways and his face flopped forward into the water. "Come on, wake up." With a stinging slap, Ruffy's open hand hit Bruce across the cheek. The shock roused him. He coughed, and a mixture of water and vomit shot up his throat and out of his mouth and nose. Then he belched painfully and retched again. "How's it feel now?" Ruffy demanded. Bruce lifted a hand from the water and wiped his mouth. He felt much better. "Okay, can you make it?" Bruce nodded. "Let's go then." With Ruffy dragging and pushing him, he worked his way up the pile. Water poured from his clothing as his body emerged. His hair was plastered across his forehead, and he could feel each breath gurgle in his lungs. "Listen, boss. When we get to the top, we'll be in the open again. There'll be more arrows. Not time to sit around and chat. We're going over the rail fast, and then run like hell, okay?" Bruce nodded again. Above him were the floorboards of the bridge. With one hand he reached up and caught an upright of the guardrail, and he hung there without strength to pull himself the rest of the way. "Hold it there," grunted Ruffy, and wriggled his shiny wet bulk up and over. The arrows started falling again. One pegged into the wood 6 inches from Bruce's face and stood there quivering. Slowly, Bruce's grip relaxed. "I can't hold on," he thought. "I'm going." Then Ruffy's hand closed on his wrist. He felt himself dragged up, his legs dangled. He hung suspended by one arm, and the water swirled smoothly past 20 feet below. Slowly, he was drawn upwards. His chest scraped over the guardrail, tearing his shirt. Then he tumbled over it into an untidy heap on the bridge. Vaguely, he heard the guns firing on the south bank, the flit and thump of the arrows, and Ruffy's voice. "Come on, boss. Get up." He felt himself being lifted and dragged along. With his legs boneless soft under him, he staggered beside Ruffy. Then there were no more arrows. The timbers of the bridge became solid earth under his feet, voices and hands on him. He was being lifted, then lowered face down onto the wooden floor of a truck. The rhythmic pressure on his chest as someone started artificial respiration above him, the warm gush of water up his throat, and Charmaine's voice. He couldn't understand what she was saying, but just the sound of it was enough to make him realize he was safe. Darkly, through the fog, he became aware that her voice was the most important sound in his life. He vomited again. Hesitantly at first, and then swiftly, Bruce came back from the edge of oblivion.
"That's enough," he mumbled, and rolled out from under Sergeant Jacques, who was administering the artificial respiration. The movement started a fresh paroxysm of coughing, and he felt Charmaine's hands on his shoulders restraining him. "Bruce, you must rest." "No," he struggled into a sitting position. "We've got to get out into the open," he gasped.
"No hurry, boss. We've left all the bloobs on the other bank. There's a river between us."
"How do you know?" Bruce challenged him.
"Well, you don't," Bruce told him flatly. "There could easily be another few hundred on this side."
He coughed again painfully and then went on.
"We're leaving in 5 minutes. Get them ready."
"Okay." Ruffy turned to leave.
"Ruffy."
"Boss?"
He turned back expectantly.
"Thank you."
Ruffy grinned self-consciously.
"That's all right. I needed a wash anyway."
"I'll buy you a drink when we get home."
"I won't forget," Ruffy warned him, and climbed down out of the truck.
Bruce heard him shouting to his boys.
"I thought I'd lost you."
Charmaine's arm was still round his shoulders, and Bruce looked at her for the first time.
"My sweet girl, you won't get rid of me that easily," he assured her.
He was feeling much better now.
"Bruce, I want to... I can't explain."
Unable to find the words, she leaned forward instead and kissed him, full on the mouth. When they drew apart, Sergeant Jacques and the two gendarmes with him were grinning delightedly.
"There is nothing wrong with you now, Captain."
"No, there isn't," Bruce agreed. "Make your preparations for departure." From the passenger seat of the Ford, Bruce took one last look at the bridge. The repaired section hung like a broken drawbridge into the water. Beyond it, on the far bank, were scattered a few dead baluba, like celluloid dolls in the sunlight. Far downstream, the gasoline tanker had been washed by the current against the beach. It lay on its side, half submerged in the shallows, and the white shell insignia showed clearly. And the river flowed on, green and inscrutable, with the jungle pressing close along its banks.
"Let's get away from here," said Bruce.
Charmaine started the engine, and the convoy of trucks followed them along the track through the belt of thick river bush and into the open forest again. Bruce looked at his watch. The inside of the glass was dewed with moisture, and he lifted it to his ear.
"Damn thing, stop. What's your time?"
20 minutes to 1.
"Half the day wasted," Bruce grumbled.
"Will we reach Msapa Junction before dark?"
"No, we won't. For 2 good reasons. Firstly, it's too far, and secondly, we haven't enough gas."
"What are you going to do?"
Her voice was unruffled. Already she had complete faith in him. "I wonder how long it'll last," he mused cynically. "At first you're a god. You have not a single human weakness. They set a standard for you, and the standard is perfection. Then, the first time you fall short of it, their whole world blows up."
"We'll think of something," he assured her.
"I'm sure you will," she agreed complacently, and Bruce grinned. The big joke, of course, was that when she said it, he also believed it. Damned if being in love doesn't make you feel one hell of a man. He changed to English so as to exclude the two gendarmes in the back seat from the conversation. "You are the best thing that's happened to me in 30 years.
"Oh, Bruce."
She turned her face towards him, and the expression of trusting love in it and the intensity of his own emotion struck Bruce like a physical blow.
"I will keep this thing alive," he vowed. "I must nourish it with care and protect it from the dangers of selfishness and familiarity."
"Oh, Bruce, I do love you so terribly much. This morning, when I thought I had lost you, when I saw the tanker go over into the river..."
She swallowed, and now her eyes were full of tears.
"It was as though the light had gone. It was so dark and cold without you."
Absorbed with him so that she had forgotten about the road, Charmaine let the Ford veer and the offside wheels pumped into the rough verge.
"Hey, watch it," Bruce cautioned her.
"Dearly as I love you, also, I have to admit that you're a lousy driver. Let me take her.
Do you feel up to it?
Yes, pull into the side.
Slowly, held to the speed of the lumbering vehicles behind them, they drove on through the afternoon. Twice they passed deserted Baluba villages beside the road, the grass huts disintegrating and the small cultivated lands about them thickly overgrown.
My God, I'm hungry. I've got a headache from it and my belly feels as though it's full of warm water, complained Bruce.
Don't think you're the only one. This is the strictest diet I've ever been on. Must have lost 2 kilos.
But I always lose in the wrong place, never on my bottom.
Good, Bruce said. I like it just the way it is. Never shed an ounce there.
He looked over his shoulder at the 2 gendarmes.
Are you hungry? He asked in French.
Mon Dieu, exclaimed the fat one. I will not be able to sleep tonight if I must lie on an empty stomach.
Perhaps it'll not be necessary.
Bruce let his eyes wander off the road into the surrounding bush. The character of the country had changed in the last 100 miles.
This looks like game country. I've noticed plenty of spoor on the road. Keep your eyes open.
The trees were tall and widely spaced, with grass growing beneath them. Their branches did not interlock so that the sky showed through. At intervals there were open glades filled with green swamp grass and thickets of bamboo and ivory palms.
We've got another 30 minutes of daylight. We might run into something before then.
In the rear-view mirror he watched the lumbering column of transports for a moment. They must be almost out of gasoline by now. Hardly enough for another 30 minutes driving. There were compensations, however. At least they were in open country now, and only 80 miles from M'Sapa Junction. He glanced at the petrol gauge. 30 tanks. The ranchero still had sufficient to get through, even if the trucks were almost dry.
Of course. That was the answer. Find a good camp, leave the convoy, and go on in the Ford to find help.
Without the trucks to slow him down, he could get through to M'Sapa Junction in 2 hours. There was a telegraph in the station office, even if the junction was still deserted.
"We'll stop on the other side of this stream," said Bruce, and slowed the Ford, changed into second gear, and let it idle down the steep bank.
The stream was shallow. The water hardly reached the hubcaps as they bumped across the rocky bottom. Bruce gunned the Ford up the far bank into the forest again.
"There!" shouted one of the gendarmes from the back seat, and Bruce followed the direction of his arm.
Standing with humped shoulders close beside the road, bunched together with mournfully drooping horns, heads held low beneath the massive bosses, bodies very big and black, were 2 old buffalo bulls. Bruce hit the brakes, skidding the ranchero to a stop, reaching for his rifle at the same instant. He twisted the door handle, hit the door with his shoulder and tumbled out onto his feet. With a snort and a toss of their ungainly heads, the buffalo started to run. Bruce picked the leader and aimed for the neck in front of the plunging black shoulder. Leaning forward against the recoil of the rifle, he fired and heard the bullet strike with a meaty thump. The bull slowed, breaking his run. The stubby foreleg settled, and he slid forward on his nose, rolling as he fell, dust and legs kicking. Turning smoothly without taking the butt from his shoulder, swinging with the run of the second bull, Bruce fired again, and again the thump of bullet striking. The buffalo stumbled, giving in the legs. Then he steadied and galloped on like a grotesque rocking horse, patches of baldness grey on his flanks, big-bellied, running heavily. Bruce shifted the bead of the foresight onto his shoulder, and fired twice in quick succession, aiming low for the heart, hitting each time. The bull so close he could see the bullet wounds appear on the dark skin. The gallop broke into a trot, with head swinging low, mouth open, legs beginning to fold. Aiming carefully for the head, Bruce fired again. The bull bellowed, a sad, lonely sound, and collapsed into the grass. The lorries had stopped in a line behind the Ford, and now from each of them swarmed black men. Jabbering happily, racing each other, they streamed past Bruce to where the buffalo had fallen in the grass beside the road.
"Nice shooting, boss," applauded Ruffy. "I'm going to have me a piece of tripe the size of a blanket."
"Let's make camp first. Bruce's ears were still singing with gunfire. Get the lorries into a ring. I'll see to it. Bruce walked up to the nearest buffalo and watched for a while as a dozen men strained to roll it onto its back and begin butchering it. There were clusters of grape-blue ticks in the folds of skin between the legs and body. A good head, he noted mechanically. 40 inches at least.
Plenty of meat, Captain. Tonight we eat thick, grinned one of his gendarmes as he bent over the huge body to begin flensing.
Plenty, agreed Bruce, and turned back to the ranchero. In the heat of the kill it was a good feeling. The rifles kick and your stomach screwed up with excitement. But afterwards you feel a little bit dirted, sad and guilty, as you do after lying with a woman you do not love. He climbed into the car, and Charmaine sat away from him, withdrawn.
They were so big and ugly, beautiful, she said softly.
We needed the meat. I didn't kill them for fun. But he thought, with a little shame, I have killed many others for fun.
Yes, she agreed. We needed the meat.
He turned the car off the road and signalled to the truck drivers to pull in behind him.